Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by Cam Maitland and Alicia Fletcher. If you were a subscriber to the New York Times in December 1982, and you opened up to the movie reviews, you would have seen famed reviewer Vincent Canby tearing a particular film to shreds with lines like, "The screenplay by David O'Dell, based on a story by Mr. Henson, is without any narrative drive whatsoever. It's without charm as well as interest," and that Miss Piggy would not be kind to the Dark Crystal, though I don't know if she would go so far as to sigh, "Kel Bohr." And finally, the Dark Crystal contains some fairy tale violence that is often difficult to see clearly. While I think Mr. Canby is a fine reviewer, I think he was a little harsh on failing to recognize the technical achievements and marvels that bring the world of the Dark Crystal to life. But I do think he hits the nail on the head with the biggest challenge of any fantasy movie: the balance of a strong narrative, compelling, relatable characters, and a transportative world that is like nothing we know, but that we still believe exists. Fantasy movies are hard to pull off, debatably harder than any other genre. But the 80s were rife with them, sprawling, large budget, and ambitious, although not always successful financially or narratively. We're going to look at two of them today. But first, Cam, Alicia, where were fantasy movies in the mid-80s? Why did they boom? I think I know why.
I'm giving this to Cam. Cam knows what he's saying.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I also feel like I'm going to talk a bit about fantasy novels, which I know Becky is the supreme nerd here, so
feel free
to correct me if I...
I have quoted Terry Pratchett twice on this podcast.
Yeah,
don't start.
But yeah, so I mean, Star Wars is there's kind of two streams. Stream one is Star Wars. I would also say the interesting thing to consider is Superman at the time was considered a fantasy movie.
True. Okay.
Superhero movies were fantasy movies until now when they are their own genre. So yeah, basically you could make a movie. And of course, we're talking about 1986. By the time 1986 comes along, there was three Star Wars that were successful throughout, making tons of money all over. So that's one thing, but I will get back
Muppets,
to that.
The last one.
I was just thinking that.
Last two had Muppets.
I mean, I know you could argue that some of the early things were close to Muppets.
Well, it's actually one of the reasons why Jim Henson had to start his Creature Workshop was because George Lucas kept hiring all them away, and then he'd have to hire them back. And then he's like, you know what? I'm just going to make one central place, and you can hire them from there. So I just keep that. I can keep them.
Yeah. So it's like, I mean, obviously people want that. And the other thing to keep in mind is that Star Wars is much more a fantasy film set in outer space than a science fiction film. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of things, which is to say the book side, fantasy novels were bigger than ever. We talked last season a bit about The Silmarillion coming out in 1977, which caused a kind of reboom after the 60s reboom of J.R.R. Tolkien. But on top of that, 1977 was this massive year for fantasy because Terry Brooks' Sword of Shannara came out. Some lesser kind of forgotten huge hits like Catherine Kurtz's The Chronicles of Durrani and The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant by Stephen R. Donaldson. All those series and books ended up essentially creating like bestseller fantasy, like fantasy books and series that were making more money than ever before. Mm. Book people tend to think that that is because Star Wars also, because Star Wars made people scramble so hard for science fiction that it actually tanked the science fiction novel market.
Interesting.
And at the time, science fiction and fantasy were very much attached. So when science fiction tanked, there was big room for fantasy. As the '70s crested into the '80s. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And they say as the fantasy novels boomed and boomed, obviously there's stuff like Dragonlance also starting, which is huge. Dungeons and Dragons came out in the mid to late '70s too. So it's like suddenly everyone was real hungry for fantasy, and that opened up what kind of fantasies could be interesting. So suddenly there was what we now know as grimdark fantasy, the really gritty kind of re-examination of fantasy, which is maybe one of these movies. There was also stuff like Terry Pratchett and Piers Anthony started in the 1980s. So like the funnier stuff, which is also maybe something we will be talking about today. But yeah, it's people kind of chalk it up two ways. There was obviously a massive market for it, but also filmmakers grew up in the 60s in the Tolkien times when they were booming again. So it's interesting. In 1981, you have your first big boom of fantasy films with John Borman's Excalibur, which I think is very influential on one of the films we're talking about today.
I just remember watching that one in high school and just being horrified by being like, I think grade 10 we watched it, and I was like,
very erotic.
Yeah. I mean, it stars Helen Mirren.
Yeah, she Helen Mirren is a sexy Morgana.
Yeah. Oh my God.
It's spicy for
and started dating
school.
A very much younger Liam Neeson off of that film. Which
to tell you about this high school teacher, we also watched the Hustler version of Macbeth. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I watched that too. Yeah. It's the best Macbeth.
Let's be honest.
I think that every kid gets that one. But yeah, so Borman's Excalibur came out. You might also know in the UK when Empire Strikes Back was released, they released in front of it a short film called Black Angel, which is a high fantasy. It's only kind of recently been dug up again. It's really beautiful. It's one of the second unit people on Star Wars, I believe, directed it. Look it up. It's really cool. It's a guy fighting a black knight. It's quite a bit like Legend visually, I would say. But also in 1981, there's Clash of the Titans and Dragon Slayer. Huge, especially in the UK, these films were really hitting. Then in 1982, it essentially explodes with Conan and Beastmaster. You got, you know, Lady Hawk.
I'm sure we brought up. Yeah. I love Lady Hawk.
Yes.
I watched the trailer for that because I haven't seen it in years. I didn't have time to watch the whole thing. But my God, Matthew Broderick is Matthew Broderick no matter what century you put him in.
Oh, yeah.
And that predates Ferris Bueller by a solid 2 years, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's constant stuff. I mean, Neverending Story in 1984. In 1986, that we're talking about, there's also Highlander. And all of this kind of continues, just to like cap it off. They kind of say that the death of it is Willow, which is interesting. What we were just kind of talking about before, these films are generally considered not financially successful, even though if you were an accountant, you would be like, well, they've paid more than their budget. But the thing is, at the time, they were incredibly costly to make. They were probably the most costly option you could do, maybe even more than sci-fi sometimes, because sci-fi is built sets, at least. And also, they didn't count the international market often. These films did incredibly well in Europe. Sometimes they did very well in Asia. But you have to keep in mind that also this was like a time when those markets, it was years later. Like sometimes England, it would come out a year after it came out in America. Yeah, so you can look at some of these movies and they made a ton of money in another country.
And I think it'd be important to point out the two films we're talking about, Labyrinth and Legend, were produced outside of Hollywood. They are filmed in England. Yeah. They are, I think, a very European sensibility to making films.
Totally.
So it doesn't surprise me that they do quite well overseas and then Hollywood just writes them off as a failure, when in fact something like, and we're going to talk about The Dark Crystal, made $60 million within its first year, which is huge in 1982.
Yeah.
On a, I want to say it's like a $16 million budget. That's a huge success. That's huge.
Oh,
and yet
yeah.
somehow it gets noted as this failure in film history, which I don't get.
Not Star Wars, you know?
Yeah, and that, and I think we're going to get into it too. It's a narrative failure. Like, it's, I think that is the biggest issue. That's what Vincent Canby's pointing towards, is that, like, these are beautiful movies, but there's holes all over the place in both of these stories.
You know what?
So.
You can shut up, Vincent Canby. Because...
Well, I mean, you could also argue that it's studio meddling, that obviously we were never supposed to hear what the Skeksis were saying.
Yes.
They were supposed to just stalk in a bunch of chirps and clicks.
Which
and,
is amazing to me. As a kid.
Yeah,
I would have
so
been like, ah.
I mean, I don't know. It's very interesting, and I also think that it's fascinating because I mean, most of these movies are now I think that they're pretty much fully reclaimed.
Yeah.
But in my youth, a lot of these were like cult films, and part of the reason they're cult films, I think, is studios push them so hard on television and on video to try to make up the money they feel that they lost, that we were showed them constantly. Yeah. Yeah. So something, these movies were just constantly playing. Something like Beastmaster, there's a Beastmaster TV show, there's the sequels. It's just
But don't you feel that, you know, yes, I agree with you, like they were very front and center at a VHS rental store. And you're right, they were always on TV. I think probably my initial copies of both of these films were filmed off television. Don't you feel like once you saw them, though, you fell in love? Like, I don't think it was just like, they pushed it on me and then I became addicted. like how a drug dealer works.
But this is also the realm. We've talked about this weird limbo that exists in the 70s and 80s that did not exist in the 90s and 2000s. The concept of the family movie, where there really was something for everybody, even though the younger kids, like, say, under the age of 7 would be totally scarred by it. But it would still be okay to show it to your children. E.T. would fall into that category. Things like that, right? Mm-hmm. And both of these very, like, I mean, definitely Legend is not for kids, especially the version that they originally intended. But I can see a lot of people renting this and watching this with their children. Because it has this world of fantasy, and there's this assumption that, like, unicorns are for children, even though in this case they definitely are not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's right. Like, we're fairly new to the PG-13 idea. I think at least Legend kind of pushes it. Yeah, it's weird. It's just trying to find that. And I mean, I think it's still happening. People still are like, you know, where is the line for a kid's movie? Because obviously Disney knows you got to kill people.
Well,
where do you go with
We'll get into that when we talk about our first movie, because on paper, Labyrinth should be perfect. It should be perfect. Like, Brian Froud, illustrator of the gorgeous, haunting, and deeply rude Fairies series of books, designed the creatures. Jim Henson and his workshop brought those creatures to life. The situations they found themselves in were written, well, credited to, we're going to get into that, Terry Jones of Monty Python, and the creatures allied with and against future Oscar winner 14-year-old Jennifer Connelly. And the whole world was commanded and soundtracked by David Bowie at the height of his 80s powers. Oh, and there's a farting bog, a hospitable worm, and a scaredy cat sheepdog named Ambrosius. Adult me was honestly hesitant to rewatch this for the podcast or for the TV series, because to 5-year-old me, this movie is perfect. And Labyrinth is kind of what taught me that movies were magic. So as we go into this, please know that I am deeply, deeply biased on the actual quality of this film.
I would like to echo that bias.
Yeah.
I feel exactly the same.
Go ahead and take this out of my hands. I did try to show this to my small person. We had a debate on whether or not that was appropriate. And we were like, okay, well, we'll show them the pictures of the creatures and kind of explain the plot a little bit and see where we're at. And they were fascinated by David Bowie as the Goblin King. They were like, who's that? That's the Goblin King? Ooh. And I was like, all right, we got some cool stuff coming up. But they took a couple minutes after looking at the goblins and went, you know what? Too scary. Not for me. So we did not end up watching it together. But the rewatch, I'm glad I rewatched it with adult eyes. I'm glad I did it. So before we start, if someone somehow has not seen the film Labyrinth, let's talk about what it's about. Let's do a quick plot summary. Alicia, let's throw this one to you.
14-year-old girl played by Jennifer Connelly, who looks stunning. Like, she was cast out of a pool of amazing actresses, including like Helena Bonham Carter and Mia Sara, who we're going to talk about, because she looked so adult-like despite her years. Mm-hmm. She lives with her father and stepmom. Not a big fan of the stepmom. She's forced into a babysitting situation with her dad's new infant. And she's very theatrical. We see in her bedroom very early in the film, and I only noticed this as an adult and not as a child, that her mother, her birth mother, is a very famous actress, doesn't live with her. She obviously idolizes her. You actually see images of an actress who's supposed to be her mother with David Bowie. Mm-hmm. David Bowie, not Gareth or Jareth David Bowie. So we kind of get an idea that, like, she wants to be an actress herself. She idolizes her mom. So a theatrical little kid, as I was as well at 14, over-dramatizes everything, super spoiled, really mad that she has to stay home with her like, under the age of one infant half-brother. So she offers him up to the Goblin King. Thinking,
like you do,
assuming that this is just her kind of play acting as her parents are on a date, you know, it's pretend. what I love about Labyrinth is it just gets to the point. Like when she's doing this elaborate like speech, like Goblin King, take this child. We think it's going to wait a while before we actually see if the Goblin King exists. And it doesn't. It like within the first 10 minutes of the film, it cuts to the goblins, to the Muppets, not to the King yet, but to some of my favorite Muppet creatures ever. These little like slapstick goblins, and they're listening, and they're like, she's not saying the words right. And then finally she says them right. They come into the bedroom, steal the baby. David Bowie shows up in full Goblin King grandeur, kind of entices her and is like, you can get your little brother back, despite you clearly not wanting him back. You can get him back if you can beat my labyrinth, like get through the labyrinth that he's created in the Goblin City. And thus she embarks on that, despite not really like being conflicted. Like she really wanted to get rid of this little brat. And she does, but she kind of maybe realizes that that's wrong. So if there isn't much of a plot to this film, I mean, it really is set pieces that she works her way through the labyrinth. But if there is an overarching sort of lesson or narrative, it's, you know, think about being a spoiled, confused 14, 15 year old girl and how, you know, adulthood is coming upon you and all the confusion that is kind of wrapped up in that, that you're not a child anymore. You're like an early teenager. You're about to become an adult. How do you deal with adult responsibilities? And so that's sort of what all the challenges within the labyrinth force her to work through, that if she, you know, has confidence and just stops for a minute and calms down and thinks things through, that she will get through it. She is also sexually enticed by David Bowie. And I'm going to say, a lot of boys talk about like Farrah Fawcett being their first sort of experience with masturbation or like with arousal. A girl of a certain age, especially me, being born in 1983.
It's David Bowie.
If you saw Labyrinth let's say in the late 80s, early 90s, this was probably your first experience of like, wait, what is this? What is this? What are these feelings? I'm not supposed to have these in a children's film.
No, I'm there with you. David Bowie is extremely attractive in this film, and intentionally so. And they did their best to make him a rock star. And one of the things I think a lot of people, I definitely miss this as a child, and I'm sure in the 80s, a lot of people miss this too. This is also a dark fairy tale about grooming. And about older men who are training younger women and gaslighting them. And like, look at everything I did for you. He literally has a song about gaslighting where he's actively gaslighting her in an Escher painting. And watching it again, I was like, what an incredible message using an actual rock star to be like, watch out for this shit because it's not okay.
And a child too. Like Jennifer Connelly gets the role. She's filming it at 14. I think it's released. Mm. She's maybe 15 or 16. At most. So this is an adolescent. This isn't an instance which I think would happen now where you cast, you know, a 21-year-old actress who looks 14. Like,
agreed.
On, what's that terrible sitcom? No, it's not terrible. The family one with Sophie Vergara. I'm always like shocked.
Oh, Modern Family.
Oh, yeah, it's like all the kids are actually in their 30s. And you're like, how is that possible?
Yeah, and I also think that they go out of their way to make her shy, like it's about essentially becoming mature and like accepting your own maturity, and they make her childish, like they make her an unlikable character. I was gonna say my friend's kids tried to watch it and they were like, ooh, will the goblins be too scary? And they didn't even get to the goblins because their kids were so upset by how mean she was to her little brother.
Yeah,
and they were like, I don't want to watch this.
I don't want to watch this woman. Little brother, like in real life. Mm. Very mean. And he was, you know, and this was a relatable content for me, even at like 9 years old.
No, I agree. And especially the fact this is a step parent, right? And like, this is an example of a step parent where like, obviously the family dynamic has not coalesced the way it should. And Alicia, you mentioned the stuff in the background about her mother being an actress, etc. Mm-hmm. Until I saw the 4K version, I didn't know that was there because because like you, I watched this off like a bad VHS, and you can't see that stuff. But watching 4K versions, you now see, oh, this world they've built. You can see all the creatures,
all
stuffed animals are all there.
All
the different references and labyrinth, and it's wild.
It's not just so she has like the headshot of David Bowie with her mom taped to her mirror on her vanity. There's also a scrapbook that I never noticed that's beside the book, Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. You actually see pages where she has made her own scrapbook dedicated to her mother and this character that David Bowie plays sort of off camera. Yeah. So when we think about this as a sexual fantasy, keep in mind, and this was way above me as a kid, this is kind of her, I mean, I don't think they're married, but like a stepdad figure, or, you know, her mother's boyfriend or her mother's creative partner, someone that her mother gets photographed with all the time, and the tabloids write about her and him, and this is who she's fantasizing about, who's going to take her away from all of this. That's dark.
I think
complicated.
Yeah. I believe like there's we're going to talk about it, but there's like a mess of like what this plot was and how this script went. And I believe at one point it was meant to be a bit of a Wizard of Oz thing,
yes,
where that character was a character. And you knew that he was the Wicked Witch and the lady on the bike. Yeah.
All right. Well, Cam, I think this is actually the perfect place to take us into this, because the making of this is, and the reason why the narrative is kind of like, sorry, what's happening? Now there's this, now there's giant fire creatures. Let's start at the very beginning of how this was conceived.
I mean, let's start at the very beginning. It's all almost hard to find the beginning. The beginning is essentially that Brian Froud, who we talked about, had the, you know, he started working with Jim Henson after the huge success of his book Fairies. He designed all the stuff in Dark Crystal. After the huge failure of Dark Crystal, Jim Henson was very frustrated, but he was like, Brian, I want to do another one. Like, let's do it. And obviously, Jim Henson, imagining him frustrated, he's almost a Mr. Rogers type. So it's like,
gosh darn it.
Yeah, gee whiz, let's do another movie.
He's
also like psychotically focused. So he gets Brian Froud. They start off, as you pointed out, thinking about Indian mythology, and eventually go between themselves like, we don't know anything about this.
No, which, thank God, they figured out we don't know anything about Indian mythology. Maybe we shouldn't make our movie about that.
Mm, yeah. Yes. And so then one of them's like, goblins.
I love the fact that they were like, okay, what was wrong with the Dark Crystal? Why didn't people connect? No humans. This one's got to have humans. So.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, well, humans. And so, yeah, essentially they have this goblin idea. Brian Froud draws this painting of a baby, because they're like, traditionally, goblins take babies, so it's this baby surrounded by goblins, which is essentially the like dance magic dance sequence he painted. And from there, he just like make a ton of paintings. It's a fantasy film. They get Dennis Lee, Canadian poet Dennis
Fraggle
Lee,
Rock.
To
Fraggle
write
Rock, Dennis
Fraggle
Lee.
Rock. There's a lot of Fraggle Rock through this. He writes what ends up being essentially a novella, which they're all relatively pleased with, actually. Then they get Terry Jones. Terry Jones has approached Jim Henson to create creatures for Eric the Viking. Eric the Viking, the book, somebody's daughter read it and was like, Jim, you should make this. So he was like, okay, Terry Jones has the right sensibility.
I think it was Lisa.
Yeah,
I
maybe.
Wrong, Lisa probably. Or Heather.
I'm trying to think whose daughter was that age at the time, but it's probably his. So anyway, he met with Terry Jones over Eric the Viking and was like, would you like to do this fantasy sort of things? We obviously now know that Terry Jones is a fantasy freak himself. He takes Dennis Lee's thing and kind of thumbs through it, says he takes two ideas from it and tosses it out pretty much entirely. I will say all of these true stories, very apocryphal, very changing person to person. So it's hard to tell.
And depending on what point in that person's life you are asking them, they have different ideas, especially Terry Jones.
Yeah. So then Terry Jones writes it up. He mocks the novella. Apparently his was just a bunch of sketches that still were not a script. They bring in another Fraggle person, Laura Phillips. I am also going to say my pet theory is they have these two guys batting it back and forth. And then they, I think, very pointedly bring in two women. So I think that they are also developing the character at the center of the film, which is a girl. So Laura Phillips comes in. She apparently does a lot of the structure. She really turns it into a script. They claim it was not funny. So then Elaine May appears, as Brian Henson says, in the night too.
Podcast favorite, Elaine May.
Literally, she flies in secretly.
Yeah, podcast favorite Elaine May comes to Jim Henson's house in the middle of the night. Apparently lives at his house for like a week, and produces a script that they say is funnier.
They just slipped,
I will say,
like,
other
plates of food under the door for her.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't want to mess with her. Yeah, you don't know if she has a gun under her pillow.
I think Elaine May thing. The reason why Elaine May would maybe be chosen for this project, because I've tried to wrap my head around this, and it's not really until recently, because she's never credited, even on IMDb. Yeah. There's so many things that she was a script doctor for that she's not credited. But she had done Tootsie, and she was brought in on Tootsie to bring a female perspective, a little bit to Dustin Hoffman's character, but not really, more to like Terry Garr and inadvertently Bill Murray's side characters. And did a really good job with those and fleshed them out. So I think there was like kind of a brand that she had going. She wasn't allowed to work in Hollywood at this point. This would have been like 84. So like Ishtar hasn't happened yet. She's really there to bring a female perspective to films. So that is interesting to me because I could tell by this point they are struggling with the perspective of Jennifer, the character that would become Jennifer Connelly's character.
I have also seen other interviews. Brian Henson says that it was joke punch up.
Yeah.
I've seen other interviews saying she was there to humanize the characters, which makes sense. I would also say, as you are much more an Elaine May expert than I, but I feel like, yeah, you definitely see her fingers all over the fact that Jennifer Connelly's character is like a dislikable protagonist.
Agreed.
Who you nonetheless root for.
Yeah, she's dislikable and a really fleshed out character because that's how I acted at 14. I thought everything should be handed to me. I was a total bitch. Like that, I watched this as an adult and like, did this film train me to be like that because I watched it when I was little? Or is this just a very accurate portrayal of a middle-class teenage girl who wants everything?
Totally, yeah. I mean, she's just, like, lightly spoiled. It's not too wild. And I will also say the other thing that I think is very Elaine May is how quickly it starts.
Yeah,
what you're talking about, that, like, it's totally pared down. Like, I think she would say, don't write a thing about the mother and the whatever. Have a couple of photos.
Get those goblins in there.
Just get it. Yeah, yeah. Just get straight to the goblins. I mean, Jim Henson talks about Terry Jones's draft didn't reveal the Goblin King till, like, the midway through the third act.
Yeah.
And he was like, no. He's like, Goblin King first 15 minutes,
yeah,
please.
And that draft, you don't even get to go to the Goblin City until, like, I don't even know if you got there. Terry Jones thought it was important to not show because it would keep it mysterious. Whereas it was like, if we're paying for David Bowie to write original songs, David Bowie must be in the film throughout.
Yeah. So I don't know. And so anyway, the Elaine May happens. It goes back to Terry Jones. And then this is, I think, the most confounding is, depending on how you hear from Terry Jones, he either went back to an earlier draft and rewrote it, or he also says that he's the sole credited writer. Mm-hmm. He says that he feels fairly divorced from the final film. I don't know whether that is because of Laura Phillips and Elaine May, or because, I mean, the other thing is Muppet people are notorious improvisers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do think that you can really sit down if you were a maniac and choose joke by joke what is Elaine May and what is Terry Jones style. Like, I think the heads that go like, beware, wait, I want to say my thing.
Don't pay any attention to them. They're just false alarms. You get a lot of them in the labyrinth, especially when you're on the right track.
Oh, no, you're not.
Oh, shut up.
I'm sorry, just doing my job.
Well, you don't have to do it to us.
Beware, Fuzzer.
Just forget it.
Like, that is very Terry Jones. I think the fact that every time they talk about Hoggle, they miss-say his name is very Elaine May.
Hello, Hedgewort.
Hogwart.
Hoggle?
Hoggle.
I think calling him Hogwart, calling him Humpback or whatever is, that seems more like her.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a mess, but I also know that, like, George Lucas says Yoda was barely written the day they shot.
Yeah.
And that was just Frank Oz and Irving Kershner improvising and coming up with what Yoda was like.
At
the end of the day, one of the reasons I love this movie so much and what I've held on to is the moments, like the little individual jokes that have just killed me. The hat is, like, one of my favorite things.
The way forward is sometimes the way back.
Hey, will you listen to this crap?
Will you please be quiet?
All right.
Okay.
All right. Sorry.
The worm is one of my favorite things.
Can we talk about the worm?
Of course we can talk about the worm. And these are just like little, like, maybe two-minute moments, but they're so memorable and so quotable to me. I mean, it's so stimulating. Being your hat is fucking funny.
Yeah. And again, that could be just off the cuff.
Okay, so then we've talked about David Bowie. At what point does David Bowie come in? Because I know he was not choice number one, and he had to be fought for, weirdly.
Well, I mean, this is also all over the place, because Jim Henson went to his children and said, children, who is cool? he was kind of like, he was thinking about Sting, who,
Which makes sense.
A pretty significant actor at the time.
Well, and he was coming off Dune, too.
He's coming off Dune.
Yeah, obviously... arguably, this film might be too horny with Sting. he already had a famous codpiece, but he was kind of thinking of Michael Jackson,
which is insane.
But which is insane. But Brian Henson is like, I was deep in the dyed wool new romantic, and I was like, it must be David Bowie.
Which makes sense for this film. Like, I literally cannot imagine Michael. What a different yeah. film with Michael Jackson, and the fact that, like, you want a romantic lead, and there's nothing romantic yeah. about Michael Jackson. I'm sure some people yeah, find yeah. him very attractive, but that's, you know, he's just
yes,
not a sex symbol.
That is even a thing that Jim Henson said. Michael Jackson was, to him, a children's performer, and David Bowie was an adult performer. Mm-hmm. So the funniest story you hear is David Bowie talks about, you know, Jim Henson, I think, showed up maybe on the Serious Moonlight tour mm-hmm. just backstage one day with a stack of Brian Froud's drawings. And he was like, you are the Goblin King. And David Bowie's like, sure, you know, I like kid stuff. I would like to do another kid's thing.
Didn't he say, I've already done the Laughing Gnome, so I can just do this?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Just go full
on. And I think
on.
Some of the, we've talked about this on the podcast, like with our episode on The Hunger, and I think 1983, he also does the Nagisa Oshima film, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Like, he clearly was looking to shed some of this, like, really serious, dour, dark roles, and then ended up landing in a very serious, dark, sexually menacing, yeah. terrifying role, which I love.
Oh, yeah. And it's also fascinating because to hear David Bowie tell it is another one of those ones where it's like he agreed to it. Jim Henson disappeared for years and he never heard anything. And then it was like, ring, ring, time to be the Goblin King. He was like, huh? Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
that,
exactly.
That itself is a bit like fairy tale. Like, the time yeah. has come. Report to set for your cause.
I think it's really important, too, that it's not just like, okay, you're the Goblin King and you're going to be, it's not a little character. Mm. You are top billed. You are throughout the whole film. It was free reign on all songs. There was no production or studio intervention on the music. These are David Bowie songs. I've seen people kind of question whether they're David Bowie songs because, you know, they're for a kid's film. These are David Bowie songs. These are quintessential to me David Bowie songs. And Jim Henson had such success with this strategy with someone like Paul Williams, giving Paul Williams full reign. Just, you know, he's not going to intervene on these songs. And look at how many Oscar nominations that led to for things like Rainbow Connection and really, really famous Muppet songs. Dance, Magic, Dance. If I'm feeling down, even though, like, that is a song about stealing a baby, it's so good. Like, I understand the criticism that this is too music video-y because of David Bowie interludes like that. I don't care. Like,
no, it's perfect. And it makes sense. Tonally, it's perfect. The minute I watch, like, I watched the trailer today just to be like, okay, how did they cut this thing? Mm-hmm. And, like, the minute any of that music starts playing, I go on Spotify and I load up the album and I have to listen to the whole thing. Like, it's so good. And it's very, like, David Bowie of that period. Like, I'm sorry, I got to get into my nerd here because he's, like, Let's Dance is 83. So that was, like, his big commercial hit. That's what brought him back. Critically, not so much. But, like, you start getting into, like, 84 is Tonight, and, like, his biggest hit off that was Loving the Alien, even though Tonight is a duet with Tina Turner, and it didn't do quite as well.
No one remembers that album.
Exactly, and that's unfortunate. And then he really doesn't come back until Black Tie, White Noise in 93. And, like, Labyrinth is almost entirely skipped over, which is so weird because it's so catchy. Like, I think it's one of his most commercially viable albums.
Can we talk about one of the lyrics in there, which I get in my head all the time, which is, you remind me, so the main lyric is, you remind me of the babe, and the goblins respond like, babe from the what or something like that, and he's like, hoodoo voodoo, which I was like, who? Even as a child, I was like, what fascinating lyrics. Then as an adult, and Cam, can you remind me, were you at that particular Nitrate Film Festival when they showed?
No, I was not.
Okay. So there's a Nitrate Film Festival in Rochester that I go to when it's not COVID, and they show the classic 1947 film, although it's not that classic because I hadn't actually seen it, with Cary Grant and kind of Shirley Temple in her first adult role, called The Boxer and the Bobby Soxer, or sorry, The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer. He just pulled the dialogue straight from that film. So watching it in a theater with, I think, around 300 or 400 people, Cary Grant says, you remind me of the man, instead of babe, man. And Shirley Temple says, what man? He says, hoodoo, voodoo.
Hey, you remind me of a man.
What man?
The man with the power.
What power?
The power of hoodoo.
Hoodoo?
You do.
Do what?
Remind me of a man.
The whole audience went like, what?
I was like, what? Like, where did this come from?
Anyone of a certain age, their brain was going, that's Labyrinth. This is what? Like, those are the lyrics from The Magic Dance? Is this 1947 lesser-known Cary Grant film, The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer? So, I mean, that's pure David Bowie. That's something that no one could really intervene. He writes that. It gets performed. They're just like, fine.
Totally. I mean, it's like the improv of it all, because that's also, you know, they're talking about that set. I think I did a thing on Hollywood Suite about it. It's like that set had chickens, it had 50 puppets, it had marionettes, it had
and
a
people
real
in goblin, like 12 goblins, yes. Like goblin small people in goblin suits, like human actors running
being
around,
being flown around.
This is Jennifer Connelly's first thing, and she's having to work on a Swiss cheese set. That's wild.
I'm also fascinated by that because her early movies are like Phenomena, where she's covered in bugs and stuff. This 7 Minutes in Heaven, which we have on Hollywood Suite, which is a cute Degrassi thing. But yeah, it's very fascinating. I also am super fascinated. She was a model at the time. Her modeling career somehow got her a brief recording artist career in Japan.
At she like has, 13.
She has two pretty high-ranking pop songs about when Labyrinth is released in Japan. So the film is actually huge in Japan because she has this song called Monologue of Love, which is in phonetic Japanese. And it's like a folk song. It's like a Christmas-related album, too. It's very weird, but she's so good. And it's also fascinating because Jim Henson, when he talks about her, he's like, number one, she's amazing. And obviously, you don't need to say she's amazing because she had a continuing career for the rest of her life.
She must have been super professional to be doing this young. And a very this was difficult for Bowie to figure out how to work with puppets. Imagine being 14 years old and trying to wrap your head around this.
I've heard her do contemporary interviews where she says she likes working with the puppets better than the humans.
Yeah, I believe that.
And I mean, the other thing that Jim Henson admits is he's like, when you're writing a puppet movie, you're like, the puppet does this, the puppet does that. And then he's like, we get on set with Jennifer Connelly, and I'm like, oh, she is constantly doing stunts. He is like a less professional actress would have been in full rights to be like, stop dumping me down holes and in the water, and I don't want to be on a crumbling bridge. He's like, the whole movie, she's just
stench.
He's like, it's just constantly stunts if you really think about it. And he's like, we really pushed her to the limit, and she was professional the whole way.
And when you think about the little people performers as well, which there are several of them, the main little person performer being Sherry Weiser, who's inside the Hoggle animatronic and who's basically doing almost, I'd say it's a third of the performance, because you have someone doing the face, then Brian Henson is doing the voice, and then you have her doing the body of it. One of the little facts that I love is that the reason why he's always making those noises is because she kept having to open the mouth because that's how she can see.
So if you were acting against Hoggle, you would see these pair of eyeballs in his mouth, which this whole film is about the uncanny. So like, there's so much uncanniness just in the production of this. And I think it's Brian Henson actually controlling the animatronic face through a Waldo and doing the voice. So you would also have the voice coming, you know, he's on set doing the voice. So the voice is coming from a different direction or a different area, but you have to then act as though it's coming out of the mouth while there's these two little eyeballs looking at you.
And then speaking to the uncanniness, there's a great YouTube clip that I really want people to go see because it's so beautiful. It's the Royal Command performance of Labyrinth in 86 with Prince Charles and Diana meeting Ludo, the giant creature. And she is so creeped out by Ludo. She's just making these faces like, what the hell am I looking at? And she's trying to be gracious because she's freaking Diana. But when David Attenborough makes the puppet curtsy to her, she like does like a beeline away from it, like to get as far as possible. And she's just like, nope.
My favorite Ludo fact is one of the guys who was puppeteering and the voice of it was an Australian puppeteer, a second generation puppeteer named Ron Muick. And you might know him as a hyper-realist sculptor. He's got the guy who essentially popularized those sculptures that look like real people. He had one in 1996 called Dead Dad, which is quite famous. But yeah, it's a very weird side note that Ludo's voice is also an incredibly famous visual artist and sculptor.
Another side note, coming back to that London premiere where Princess Diana and Prince Charles were in attendance, apparently, according to Jim Henson, Prince Charles came up to him and was like, he really enjoyed the film. He wasn't the average audience member. He wasn't the average critic. He really liked it. And he told Jim Henson his favorite part was the farting scene. He just kept laughing.
Amazing.
He's like, I just thought that was so delightful, the farts.
I mean, that's a great scene.
That's what inbreeding does to you. And I'm not taking that out of the podcast.
No. It's just a fascinating, incredibly complex movie, which I think is like the technical complexity is interesting. The fact that Jim Henson had the power. I think he teamed up with George Lucas to produce the movie, partially to allow him to give him like breathing room, because he was kind of a guarantor. He prepped for like a year. Like, what with these movies, it's so fascinating because they did so much rehearsal and so much conceptualizing. And I think that kind of stuff is unfortunately totally lost. But I also think it's like you could say like, ah, well, now, you know, CGI has ruined everything. But this is also a very early CGI test because Jim Henson loved CGI.
Yeah.
It's the first, like, what they call the first photorealistic animal from CGI. But it's like, yeah, you need to keep in mind that Jim Henson loved technology.
And, yeah.
There's so much in this movie. Like, the great thing about this movie that is, like, different from a lot of the other films where we're like, come on, obscure interviews anywhere. Like, let's look on archive.org. This one, there's just so much information. We could do, like, a three. You could do a whole series on Labyrinth.
We could do the whole episode just on the worm. Like, you could just take that two-minute...
The worm is amazing. Please, Alicia, let's get into the worm. I promised you.
I don't have anything analytical or... both as a child and as an adult, that little worm, it's one of probably the smallest Muppets ever built. There are some other worms that are used in Sesame Street, but like this is a really tiny puppet that's performed by Karen Prell coming off of Fraggle Rock. She's Red in Fraggle Rock. And the voice is Timothy Bateson, who's like a pretty famous British actor. That line plays in my head all the time, like, hello.
Hello.
Did you say hello?
No, I said hello, but that's close enough.
You're a worm, aren't you?
Yes, right.
You don't by any chance know the way through this labyrinth, do you?
Oh, me? No, I'm just a worm.
Oh.
Come inside, meet the missus.
Every time I'm at a castle in Europe, which isn't that frequent, but when I am, that line where it's like, oh, we should have gone that way. Should have been led straight to the castle. It's like just such a, I don't know. I think if we're in a really hard economic times right now, but if you can figure out how to make a worm themed thing on Etsy, it's probably going to sell out. That would be my like economic plan for
The worms. It's got the big eyes. It looks like Baby Yoda or I don't know. I don't watch The Mandalorian. Grogu. Thank you. People are
you don't have to watch The Mandalorian to know Baby Yoda's name.
I am so busy. I'm sorry.
Call him by
I'm watching
his name.
Movies for this podcast. Yes, I am. So yeah. So I mean, that's 100%. That's like the same kind of
thing.
There's
a lot
of
histories on the worm online that I would encourage listeners to like a really deep dive into how the worm was made. Karen Prell is one of my favorite Muppeteers, and she's still with them. I just want to give a shout out to the worm. I think he really holds the film together.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's so much to shout out. Great vests. Yeah. Jennifer Connelly's wonderful vest.
How about the chili down with madness? The scary, that's what scared me as a child.
The fire guys,
The fire guys who take their heads off and throw them around were scarier to me than like the creatures that I think are meant to be designed to be more horror-based. Mm. Like these were like, I think it was probably my first experience of the uncanny as a child of like.
And they're so frantic and so frenetic and unpredictable. There's something really upsetting about them.
Sure.
Yes.
I mean, they poke their own eyes out. That was my problem as a kid.
That's fun. Oh, man. Okay. I think that's probably where we should leave it for this is poking our own eyeballs out. when we come back, we're going to look at a movie that made Time magazine critic Richard Corliss write in his reviews opening. A long time ago, in a conference room far, far away, it was ordained that sword and sorcery movies would be the next big thing. Just imagine crossing the fantasy worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien and George Lucas, mythic reverberations, megabucks, didn't work. Was he being too harsh? Nah, that's coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
25 million dollars. That's over $73 million in today's money. That's how much Ridley Scott was given to make the 1986 fantasy epic Legend. By 1986, Ridley had already proven he could create memorable and tactile worlds, as well as incredibly profitable films, with Alien and Blade Runner. So, with this new financial investment, Ridley was tasked to create an incredible fantasy world on the soundstages of the UK's iconic Pinewood Studio, on the 007 soundstage. And he and his team did, building comprehensive enchanted forest sets and vivid burning hellscapes. Weirdly, it wasn't the hellscapes that ended up burning that soundstage to the ground. It's a story that involves rogue pigeons, but we're going to get into that. But first, let's get into legend that has ironically been mostly forgotten. All right, Cam, legend. What's this one about?
Sure. I mean, it is a classic fairy tale, essentially. It is weirdly, we'll say that we'll get into it. There's a million cuts. I'm going to talk about the director's cut because that's the one that has a plot that makes sense.
And that's the one Alicia and I watched. Yeah. I've never seen this movie before.
And I would really, really emphasize to listeners, please watch the director's cut if you haven't seen it, so you can judge this film properly.
Yeah, we'll judge the film with the plot rather than the other cuts essentially cut like a little out of every scene in a way that just ruins the narrative. So the plot is basically that darkness, this supreme evil, wants darkness always because he hates the light. It is his weakness. And he realizes that the way to get that is to kill all the unicorns. So he tasks Blix, his vilest goblin, to go and kill these unicorns. Meanwhile, Princess Lily is hanging out in the forest, played by Mia Sara, and she has a flirty relationship with Jack, who is kind of a, you know, a forest-dwelling boy.
Woodland, one of those woodland sprite.
I think he's meant to be a human, but he's just a, like a Robin Hood, and he kind of hangs out with
the fairies. He's your regular forest child.
Yeah.
That's just what they do.
They did talk about making him green-skinned, so there is kind of a Jack of the Woods thing, but
I think his full name is Jacko the Green. Yeah. I think that's the full name of the character. Yeah, okay.
In their flirtations, he takes her to see the unicorns. She touches a unicorn, which sends the world out of balance, allows one of them to be seemingly killed. And from there, it's essentially a split story where Jack is trying to find Lily, and Lily is trying to make up for the fact that one of these unicorns was seemingly killed by both keeping the other unicorn safe, and eventually she gets captured by darkness and trying to do what she can from the inside to stop darkness from taking over entirely.
If Labyrinth was like very Wizard of Oz in terms of its fantasy, Legend is so like actual 19th century romanticism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It overwhelms me that this film exists. It really is like true fantasy. Like it's hard fantasy. Like Labyrinth might be soft fantasy. This is like hard fantasy.
Yeah. And I'm shocked I'd never seen this before. And the only reason I knew it was because of the design of Tim Curry's outfit as Darkness, because that is amazing.
It's
looks so cool.
It's a feat of engineering.
It is.
Rob Bottin, who's in charge, did all the prosthetic makeup, like, yes. And he worked with John Carpenter on The Thing. So like, what a pedigree. It's not, to me, I don't even think of it as makeup. It is like a design feat or an engineering feat like the Eiffel Tower. It's unbelievable. And for any, I'm sure every listener hearing this episode has seen at least a photo of Tim Curry as Darkness / the Devil. It's a character that, when I think about visual reference, I definitely think of like the Bald Mountain sequence of Fantasia. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Haxan, a silent film, Witchcraft Through the Ages from 1922. But this to me is the best depiction of the devil or darkness or evil on screen. I can't believe how scary, genuinely, but also mesmerizing and alluring, and how these prosthetics, there's no CGI, how these like practical effects could achieve this. It's so effective.
He's also 13 feet tall.
On stilts. Running.
Actually, with the horns, he is 13 feet tall. Tim Curry is 5'9". Like, it's one of those things where you're like, I've seen him in heels. I understand he's a larger man. He's only 5'9".
Yeah.
So when you think someone who's 5'9 being made 13 feet tall and having to give a performance, which he does, he acts the shit out of this like he does
incredible.
Everything else. It's incredible. If you're going to watch this movie, you watch it for him and for the other character actors, because Mia Sara and Tom Cruise can bite it as far as I care.
He won a Saturn Award for this, right? So we talk about this film as a financial failure, which it kind of was, and a critical failure, but it had, even in 1985, 86, 1986. It's released in North America in April of 1986. It had premiered in a very different version in late 1985 in England. So it gets, when you Google it, you're going to see 1985. We're calling it 1986 because that is when the majority of people saw it, and it's when it was really reviewed critically. I can't, like, it started winning things in 1986. Like, we're going to talk about this as a disaster somewhat, but it's kind of not, just like Labyrinth, where it's like, it's a misnomer in some ways.
It's definitely like a bigger an influence, I would say. And it's also kind of interesting because Ridley Scott, it's kind of one of his last, until he comes back recently, like sci-fi fantasy mm-hmm. movies. He gets into more realist films for a long time. And he actually said he wanted to, like, quote unquote, get this out of his system. He's like, I knew I really had a fantasy in me, and I wanted to do it.
The king of the director's cuts. And it's mm-hmm. no different with this.
Like, oh, and I mean, I am also fascinated. People talk about, like, you know, the different cuts. And the cuts are often chalked up to studio meddling. And if you watch mm-hmm. the documentary on this film, he's like, no studio meddled. He's
it was
like,
him.
I did it. And he actually chalks it up to the fact that he did a screening of the DGA and there was stoned people chuckling mm-hmm. at the movie. And he was like, no, this is too serious. He's like, they don't get it. Americans don't get it. And then he like ran and he cut it like crazy. And he actually said that some studio people were like, what are you doing?
It's not just that he cut it. And the runtime is substantially different between what was released in Europe and the UK mm-hmm. and what was released in the US and what is now the director's cut. He completely rescored it. And that mm-hmm. to me has more impact than even cutting out bits of the narrative. So to appeal to an American audience, to these stoners that he encountered laughing at his film at a test screening, he commissioned Tangerine Dream, the like pretty popular at the time synth band who had done the soundtrack or would do the soundtrack for, is it Top Gun? What's the big like Days of Thunder? I can't remember which one they had done. To make this synth score, which in itself, so if you watch the US cut, and probably if you grew up with this film the way I did, you definitely saw the Tangerine Dream version. It's not bad. The music itself is fine. But it's such a tragedy because the UK European version and now the director's cut has Jerry Goldsmith's score, which that man worked on this for years and considers it his greatest work. And I hadn't seen the film with the original music on it until recently, getting the director's cut in my hands. And it makes this film that seems like kind of an 80s pop culture thing in the US version a ballet. It's very Stravinsky inspired. It's with like modern flourishes. The score is stunning. And something like the seduction scene with Mia Sara and the Black Goddess, when the Tangerine Dream scores on it, it's a music video and it doesn't match the choreography. Watching it with the Goldsmith, I'm like, oh my God, this is actual, the choreography is made for the music and vice versa. And it's perfectly matched. I really have to emphasize this. Jerry Goldsmith's score is stunning and almost was completely lost. Like they really had to find in the archives the original version of this music to make the director's cut, which, you know, and I'm so glad it's restored this way. I love mm-hmm. Tangerine Dream, but it's a different film. I work mostly in silent film, and I can see one silent film with live accompaniment, and I hate the film, and then see a different score a year later, and it radically changes the entire meaning of the film, and that's what happens with Legend.
Yeah.
Risky Business is the one you're thinking
yes,
of. For
yeah,
thank
I was
you.
Say,
sorry. thank
maybe
you.
Like,
Tom
near
Cruise,
dark, but
I named every other Tom Cruise film.
It's fine. Yeah, but I mean, I also, to emphasize, just to reveal to you, Becky, if you don't know, the way they cut the movie is like, don't imagine. I mean, a usual, when you're like, the movie was cut way down, you just think full mm-hmm. sequences were pulled. But mm-hmm. it's like Ridley Scott cut 2 minutes out of every sequence in a way
everything.
That
awful.
Really makes some of it nonsense. Like, I think the reason why people do like the American cut is that the Tangerine Dream and the truly nonsensical nature of it makes it dreamy and kind of like it's a fantasy in a way that's like, oh, you know, it appeals to those stoners who, by the way, Ridley Scott says, nowadays I would just say, hey, assholes, get out of my screen. He's like, I would just have them
I don't
removed.
Care if you didn't enjoy my 4-hour cut of Kingdom
yeah,
of Heaven. Get
exactly.
out of here.
I would have them removed. But it's very interesting because I just feel like there's stuff like Blix, the character, is not really, he's just a goblin that's around. Here it's like Blix is like the third lead. And then also stuff like, I I might be misremembering, but to me, the American cut, Mia Sara does not have agency. She's just a damsel in distress.
Absolutely.
Whereas this one, it's very fascinating because she's very actively on her own quest alongside Jack. And then it makes the tension towards the end, where you don't know if she's been corrupted by evil or not, so much better. Because you know that she probably has a secret plan all along, and Jack's going to maybe shoot her with a damn arrow.
Grant your bride one wish on this night.
You have but to ask.
I will stay here with you as you wish. But on one condition.
Anything.
I want to kill the unicorn.
Well, this is one of those movies that when I read what was intended, I think I got it more, and I respected what they were trying to do more, even though I don't think it worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The narrative is one of the most important things to me. Like, I can understand. I love effects. I love puppets. I love prosthetics. Like, all that's really, really cool to me. That's why I love horror. But for me in fantasy, I need that, like, okay, what is the journey you are actually taking me along? Mm-hmm. And from my understanding, this is intended to be a film about vices and people overcoming their vices. Mm-hmm. And so Mia Sara has to learn to, like, curb her desires for things. You know, she has to work with her impulsiveness and biding her time, and it's only in biding her time she's able to succeed. Jack has to learn what to love actually is, and to get lust out of his system, because he lusts for the Mia Sara character, but he does not love her, and he has to learn what love is. So it's overcoming whatever, like, vice you actually have to succeed.
I think speaking to that point, and yeah, I can see that, and I have a similar thing where I love this film in theory, and then every time I watch it, I feel conflicted. Then I sleep on it, and I just love it again. But the experience of watching it can be quite jarring. If you think about something like, and I never thought this would come up on the podcast, Paradise Lost, like John Milton's Paradise Lost, where you're looking at the world through the perspective of the devil.
Yeah,
I think this entire film is actually through the perspective of darkness, of Tim Curry's character, which explains why the purity of Mia Sara's character and of Jack is a little bit one-dimensional. Mm-hmm. Because he sees the world as one-dimensional. There's lightness and there's dark. He's dark. And, I mean, his character's not one-dimensional. My God.
But that's also to the credit of how great Tim Curry is. He's one of those people that you pay him, he shows up, and he makes your movie 40 times better than it was before. He's the most memorable part of about every film he's
in. And he was cast because of Rocky Horror. Like, we should say that. Like,
they wanted him to be, I mean, we should say that this is, they toned down the sexuality significantly. I can't find her name, but there was a woman executive that apparently talked to Ridley Scott. She came in and she was elderly. She was one of the, like, first women executives in Hollywood. And he said she plopped down and she was like, "You can't have the monster fuck the princess." But he was like, "We wanted the sexiest person." And then he also said that he knew any version of the design would be heavily covered in makeup, so they needed somebody with an incredibly expressive face. And he said that is Frankenfurter, right? Like, making all those horny faces is exactly what they needed.
Yeah, like, it's not even his eyes. He's got full... I think there's a behind-the-scenes sort of doc, but really Scott talks about how, like, they just eventually, in conceptualizing with Rob Bottin, these prosthetics, they just took away every part of Tim Curry. Like, first it was like, okay, well, a little bit of your cheekbones are gonna be exposed, and it's like, no, we can't do that, we gotta plaster them up. And then it was like, okay, now we're gonna put you in full sclero lenses, and he's like, all I have are my eyes left. And then he put the scleros in and was like, oh, no, I get it. This looks great.
Yeah, this works. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's fascinating. It's also, like, another credit to him that he hated it. He's one of those people, like Jim Carrey, too, that I think felt incredibly claustrophobic in that much makeup. He famously tore off parts of his skin.
He had to soak in a bath for over an hour to get the spirit gum that was used to as an adhesive soft enough that he could pull it. If he did it if he wanted to pull it off on set without that soaking bath.
Yeah.
He actually tore his skin off.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In multiple... It's,
and I mean, the fascinating thing is that this movie went on to affect It, when he played Pennywise, they wanted it to be a more elaborate character, but he had in his contract from here on out that he would not wear prosthetics like that. So
the Ridley Scott clause.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why Pennywise is like a great performance, I think, because it is a much more traditional makeup.
It's him. It's a guy in a clown makeup. It's not. It.
Yeah.
It's not a creature. Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, and it's not. It's not. We're focusing a lot on darkness. How can you not?
Yeah, there's so many terrifying creatures.
Oh my god. Yeah. Blix, his like kind of henchman, who's played by Alex Platon. Really given a bigger role in the director's cut, thank God, really cut out of the U.S. theatrical, so I love seeing the director's cut. That prosthetic is insane. Like, it's beautiful. Billy Barty is in this.
Yeah. Mm.
Like, we talked about him in the first, in our episode on Dave the Locust a little bit. You know, he is an actor that goes back to a child actor in the silent era. Like, he was in Ben Turpin shorts.
He acted opposite Mickey Rooney in Mickey Rooney's, like, Andy Hardy days. Like, it's wild.
Well, yes, but then also Mickey Rooney it's complicated. There's some uncredited stuff in the 20s that he is in with baby Mickey Rooney, which is mind-blowing. So they go back that far. But it's also like no one's been able to confirm it because a lot of those shorts are lost. But yeah, he's so good as, I don't know what kind of character he is. He's not a dwarf.
I mean, they're like brownies and pixies and sprites.
Yeah.
I will say, it's funny to me that he essentially both, they reuse the makeup and the character almost exactly in Masters of the Universe.
Yes.
When he's that little key master.
That's true. Like, the voice is the same.
Yeah, and it's almost the same face. But yeah, I think that a lot of those performers get a really fascinating showcase. And I mean, I love the Blix thing where Blix is just a like a caricature of Keith Richards.
there's a Blix line.
They're not wrong.
There's a Blix line where Darkness shows up kind of unannounced and they're to kind of like, you know, figure out what his henchmen are doing because he's frustrated that the other unicorn hasn't been captured. And I think Darkness kills off or like find out he's alive. He like basically fries, electrocutes one of the henchmen and Blix just goes, wow.
Yeah. Like, no, Blix is very funny.
It's my favorite line. It's just, wow. Yeah. I hope we get a soundbite of that because it's like the delivery and just having watched Blix's like partner get murdered. It's exactly how I feel about this film. I'm just like,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to bring this up because this is something that as I was watching this, I'm like 100% the fairy Una is Tinkerbell from Hook. Mm-hmm. Right? Sure. Like that's exactly the model for that. Okay, I thought so. Like it's got to be that same like thing. It's just they tried to make the Julia Roberts Tinkerbell more likable, but is likable. I mean, is Tinkerbell.
You see these influences visually because I think this is probably like the most visually arresting fantasy film of all
time.
It's
stunning.
And you see these weird influences. And actually there's a miscategorized thing you'll see on the internet, a fact that Shigeru Miyamoto was inspired for Legend of Zelda from this film, which wouldn't work time-wise, but you're kind of like, oh, and then people have actually said, oh, I think it's like a mistranslation, and he was actually inspired for Ocarina of Time, the N64 game, which features both a Ganon that turns into essentially darkness and a little fairy going like, hey, which is like, wait, this is a fairy going, hey, you're right.
As someone who grew up playing that game, I see that. I also see, like, I think we should mention this. Tom Cruise is in the shortest shorts probably of his career.
And has the longest hair. So it's like they were like, okay, have the two meet in the middle.
So it does look a bit like Lynx. But there's so much upper thigh, which is something my partner Brendan Ross always brings up about this film. Like there are close-ups of just like Tom Cruise's upper thigh where he's disembodied and you don't see his face, but I can tell it's his legs. It's so bizarre. This film's so bizarre. I love it so much.
Their relationship is very Link and Zelda too, where it's just like a princess hanging out who meets a woods boy, and the woods boy helps her out, and he's dumb.
I love that the unicorn stuff, coming back to fantasy, but the unicorn stuff, those shots are beautiful. They're done at Pinewood, which we're going to talk about what happened to the soundstage, but very elaborate sets, building a whole forest inside Pinewood Studios on the 007 soundstage where all the Bonds were filmed up to that point. You look like you're inside a snow globe. Like that really is, and especially in the unicorn sequences, which I think it had burned down by that point. So actually some of those are outdoors at some English estate. But he then goes and puts parts of the unicorn outtakes in Blade Runner, the director's cut. Like, he's just, trying to trace his genealogy of cut footage and where it all lands is fascinating. But I do think Blade Runner and Legend are really intimately connected somehow. I just don't, other than this unicorn footage, there is a thread there. I just haven't been able to work it out yet.
I think the release of this too is just so mishandled. So we talked about how 83 is like the year of Tom Cruise. Like he's just like bam, bam, bam. And then he goes across to the UK to do this. And there's a great interview he did with Cameron Crowe for Interview Magazine that's contemporary in like 86, right before Top Gun comes out. But he's gone to do this already. And this one also, has already come out. And he's kind of on the promotional trail for both films at the same time. Because I think it's the same studio. And so he is, he's like, I specifically wanted to go to the UK because I was starting to get mega famous here and I didn't like it. So I went to the UK and people didn't know who I was. And that was great. So I had that anonymity again. And then I was going to do this role that was completely different from anything else I'd done. Now they released this first and they knew Top Gun was coming out. Had Top Gun come out first, he would have been such a megastar at that point that everyone would have gone to see this and genuinely would not have cared about the quality of it or what it was. It was Ridley Scott, Tom Cruise. These are two of the biggest names in the film industry. It would have done way better. But for some reason, they sat on this, or some reason they released this first and waited for Top Gun.
It has a complicated co-production distribution deal. So in North America, this is Universal. But in the UK and in, I think in the UK it's Fox, and then in Europe it's something else. And then now, depending on what cut of the film it is, it has reverted back to the original single person who produced it. Like it's I've tried to show this theatrically. Can't. It's a mess. It's a total mess. And I don't want to show the US theatrical, but even that, we've had it on Hollywood Suite, right, Cam?
Yeah, we have.
Yeah. And I think we're getting it soon. As per requested, but I hope we get the director's cut. I realize I'm going to have to send an email about this just in recording this. Can we talk about this? This became almost one of the most tragic film shoots in terms of loss of life ever. And thank God it didn't. But can we give some background on that?
Of course, let's get into the fire. Before we do that, just quickly, I just want to say this was filming next door to Labyrinth at about the same time. They were in the same building. Can you imagine what that canteen was like?
Is that true? Here's my thing, though, and I'm trying to fact check that. I read that, too. Labyrinth is at Elstree Studios. And this is Pinewood, and they're not side by side.
So they did do stuff there. Here's why I know, because I listened to an interview with Brian Henson.
This is how he met
Mia? And No, they didn't.
He just almost ran her over. She does not remember almost being run over.
Brian Henson and Mia Sarah are married, just so viewers know, but not from this film, apparently.
He's like, I almost ran over a beautiful girl in what looked like pajamas. And then he's like, ah, that's Mia Sarah.
I think they did some B unit stuff at Pinewood if stuff flowed over. So they were there. Yes, it's just sense. Not at the, it's just at the same time something like that was happening. So,
Pinewood, you often see great. What was the one that I just saw? It was Jack Nicholson and James Mason from Murder by Decree visited Jack Nicholson on the set of The Shining because they were just, I don't know if that was Pinewood, but it was two UK sets that were next door.
It was Pinewood. Shining's Pinewood. I'm pretty.
And it's just silly him dressed as Watson on the Shining set.
Oh, no.
All right. Well, so, let's talk about it.
I'm glad we knew that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about this burning down because I kind of love the fact that pigeons sounded the alarm, which is just amazing to
me. I mean, it's they filled the set with birds, which was a fun idea to begin with. And it's also worth saying that this was not psychotic on Ridley Scott's part. He said that they scouted the forest and you just don't have light in the forest. So they had to essentially build a forest. They couldn't get a dense fantasy style forest that you could light. Mm-hmm. So they built this forest. You were saying that it's like gas buildup from various things. Maybe they don't really fully know what caused the fire, but essentially somebody was like sitting there and all these birds started flying out because they would leave the doors open. Because the other thing is, you got to remember this is the 80s. The ISOs were what they were. You got to light the hell out of everything.
It was very hot.
Super hot.
And it was summer too. So the roof is metal. It's basically an oven.
Yeah.
And then you would have had like gaffers up at the top normally, like actually working and doing the lighting. And then they broke for lunch.
Thank God.
Thank God. So this fire occurred during the lunch break. And then, yeah, it's the security guard who was watching the soundstage who was like, that's weird, and watched hundreds of pigeons fly out of the building like with incredible urgency, and then realized that the stage is on fire, and it became a gas ball. Like, it exploded.
Yeah. It like really scary. Super burnt down if you see it. The best recollection you can find, I think it's in the documentary, is Billy Barty being like, I was eating lunch and I saw all this smoke and I went, uh-oh.
And, you know, if there's only one, I mean, this is the 80s, I'm sure it's safer now, although this stage burned down again later on in its history. But really only one exit. You would have had hundreds of people.
Yeah.
If this occurred, there would not have been enough time to get out. And you would have had anyone who was controlling the lighting at that top part of the stage would have been probably killed instantly in the explosion.
Yeah. Thank God.
Ridley
Scott says as much, that if any of them were in there, it would have been a massive loss of life. And I mean, what Becky probably wants to talk about is the fact that Ridley Scott, they were like, Ridley, the stage is on fire. There's nothing we could do. And he went, oh. And then he's like, literally in his head, he's like, well, I could freak out about this for hours, or I could just accept there's nothing I could do. And he's like, what do I like to do to relax? And he's like, I am going to go play tennis. He literally left while the stage was on fire.
Universal's he's like, freaking I'm going to go play tennis. They're worried that he's been killed. They're like trying to contact him. He's on the tennis court. Luckily, everyone's safe.
Self-care king, because he's like, no,
well, yeah,
I need to do anything to de-stress. He's like, I cannot be a part of this massive fire ruining my entire production.
It's really sad because he had just what they were going to do after lunch. They had just set up the most elaborate tracking shot of the forest.
Yeah.
That was almost going to be like Disney Snow White, like in that it was like glass planes moving in different directions. It was going to be stunning. And then they had to break and rebuild the entire set, or then film alternative scenes. There was like a castle they found that had a kind of English garden in the background. That's just like really unfortunate. And, but a testament to like how wondrous this film is for me.
Oh, yeah.
I will give it 100%. It is beautiful. Rob Bottin's creatures are amazing. Oh. However, I will say I watched the 4K version of this, and unfortunately, you can really see their prosthetics. However, I do recognize if you were watching this on VHS or in a theater on a print, you would not see that. That would not be there. But it's one of the unfortunate things about prosthetics in 4K that it's you can see the cracks, you can see
the
strings, unfortunately.
You know, I don't know enough about this 4K. It's not a restoration, it's just a digitization. I don't think it was supervised by Ridley Scott. I don't think it's color timed by the cinematographer, who may or may not still be living. If you can, and I don't know when this will ever happen, see the director's cut that was released in 2002 with quite a number of 35mm prints. If you can see that on the big screen on 35, I think you'll be enchanted. I really do.
Darkness is a great feminist. He says that women have the greatest power, the power of creation. I don't know.
The greatest opening monologue of all time.
I am the Lord of Darkness. I require the solace of the shadows and the dark of the night.
Which was written specifically because Tim Curry did not want to be in the makeup anymore. Ridley Scott had to be like, how are we going to get him to be introduced and be in all these scenes? You don't show him. So they just have a monologue. And man, that opening monologue is so good.
Great reveal. I also just wanted to say before we end, just to credit where credit is due, the executive who told him not to have the monster have sex with the princess was Marcia Nassiter. And you can look up, she's got a documentary about her called A Classy Broad, and she's still with us, born in 1926.
I'm sure, much to Marcia's dismay, if one were to Google fan fiction.
Yeah.
There's
You hear about a heck of a lot of sexual awakenings to darkness.
Get it. I get it. And that final fight scene is actually really cool. Like, I will give that.
God.
That's really gorgeous. Okay, final thing that I have to bring up. Better villain, Darkness or Jareth?
Darkness.
Darkness?
I get the thing, and I think David Bowie played it, where it's like Darkness, or Jareth is trying to teach her a lesson. He ultimately is not trying to kill her. He's playing with her. He's toying with her.
But isn't that kind of worse? I mean, they're both sexual predators. Like, we know that. I mean, but it's you, like, which is worse?
He's the devil,
no,
Becky.
No, I'm right.
He's able to destroy the world, whereas Jareth is just, like, focused on this
I will
one
also
young
say,
girl.
I do want to make clear, we do know that Darkness has a boss because he talks to a higher mm-hmm. up at
yes,
one point.
True.
So he might not be Satan himself. He might be a mm-hmm. lesser Satan. He talks to that weird statue, whoever that is. Find out in Legend
that's
2.
That's true. Yeah, like, oh, that statue scene. We didn't even talk about that. It's so scary. Please watch
I mean,
Legend.
We didn't even talk about Meg Mucklebones, my favorite
Meg
of all the villains.
Meg Mucklebones.
Robert Picardo's breakout role.
Yeah, yeah, Meg Mucklebones, the prosthetics there, and just, yeah, that sequence is iconic. Iconic, yeah. Iconic fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's two Star Trek connections here, because we also didn't talk about Gates McFadden is the, one of the choreographers on, or that was the lead choreographer on Labyrinth.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's everything for this week. So once again, I want to thank Alicia Fletcher. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Becky. These are two films that if you told me at 7 years old, I would be 37 talking about professionally, I would be very happy. So I'm happy this came full circle.
Living the dream, living the dream. Cameron Maitland, thank you so much once again.
Thank you. I'm more of a Dark Crystal guy, but I accept these films as good.
I love it. Join us again next week where we look at two movies that are reimaginations of the 50s sci-fi B-movie. One of them plays it straight and one of them is more tongue-in-cheek. Which is more successful? We're going to talk about that next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Maines. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.